I Made This, Episode 9 with Ashkan Karbisfrushan. I'm Alyssa Thibault and this is I Made This, the podcast. Right now, there are so many weird and wonderful ways to make money by doing what you love. We can create jobs, businesses, and even lifestyles. Come with me as I speak to some of the most ambitious and dedicated people who are turning these dreams into reality, and they're making a living from it. How are they doing it? How did they get there? Well, let's find out. If you're an avid watcher of YouTube, you may not be familiar with the name of my guest today, but there is a chance that you've seen some of the content that's made by his company. Ashkan Karbisfrushan is the CEO and co-founder of Watch Mojo. It's a YouTube channel that has more than 24 million subscribers. It's the 10th largest channel on YouTube and is the most successful media brand on the platform. Mostly they do countdown videos like top 10 video game glitches or top 10 coolest celebrity mums. Basically, any topic that you have an interest in, there will be a video for it. It's based in Montreal, Canada, with around 50 full-time staff members and more than 100 freelance writers and video editors from all around the world. Now, Ash is a winner of the 2015 Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year in the media category for Quebec. He's also the author of the book, The 10-Year Overnight Success, An Entrepreneur's Manifesto. And in it, he lays out the long road it took to get the company up and running. He says the first 5 to 6 years of building it were really tough, and he tells entrepreneurs all the time that there is no quick way to success. During this interview, he talks openly and candidly about the hard parts, including a pretty excellent story about being sued by News Corp, where he represented himself in court and won. If entrepreneurship is in any way your thing, you have to hear this interview. Ash talks about learning lessons the hard way, looking after your mental health, and staying focused. He's also been very generous and to offer listeners of this podcast the chance to win a digital copy of his book. Just head to the I Made This podcast Instagram page or the website for those details. Ash, welcome to I Made This, the podcast. Where am I finding you today?
I'm in Montreal, Canada, which is where we are actually located and headquartered.
Now, for those who are not familiar with Watch Mojo, would you be able to give just a quick description of what the company is?
Sure. So Watch Mojo is known for its top 10 list pop culture, but we basically produce a lot of countdowns on entertainment, movies, gaming, music, and we've been around now for 12 years. This is our 13th year, and mm-hmm. we are the 10th largest channel on YouTube when measured by subscribers and all-time views.
That's incredible.
I say we're like the unknown startup nobody knows, but that's not really true because we have, you know, 24 million subscribers globally. So it's a big number.
That's huge. And I read somewhere that this all started because you were unhappy in your regular job.
Well, things are, happiness is relative. I was overall more but yeah, I mean, you know, I was 27. I'd worked for a few years in the media landscape, and I was always like, you know, like we should treat clients this way, we should treat employees that way. And I would butt heads with my boss, who, you know, overall was fine, but, you know, we had differences of opinions. And my last company was acquired, and I kind of didn't really have a job anymore. So it was just like the right time for me to start something. And I always say that I was the reluctant entrepreneur. But then I just said, you know what, let's just give it a try and let's see, you know, if you could build the kind of organization or the kind of, you know, company and team that you would want to be a part of. So it wasn't so much that I was like miserable or anything like that. I would say it's more that I wanted to see if my kind of theories or outlook on what a ideal organization to work for, you know, would look like and if it was even possible.
So where did the idea of creating content come from?
Well, I've always been, it's funny, I studied finance, I went to business school, but, you know, I was always drawn to storytelling. So even when I was like in high school or college and I would write essays, I always liked, you know, just telling stories and distilling, you know, like popular people's successes and, you know, describing how groups or organizations, whether musical artists or just, you know, companies came to be. I still, you know, I was always very curious about facts and history, and whether it was like the history of sports, the history of business, actual history, and pretty much all that stuff. And with the, you know, with the rise of the internet, you had this awesome platform that both had a lot of information, but where you could actually express yourself and not just write an article, but put it on a shelf or in a binder, but that other people could read. So even though I graduated from business school, I ended up kind of like, it was almost meant to be that I, instead of going and becoming like an investment banker or consultant, I fell into the world of startups, and my first job was a tech startup. But then I kind of realized I like startups, but I'm more passionate about media and the content side. So I started to write. I wrote thousands of articles in my early 20s. Then I wrote a couple of books. And then when
What were these articles about?
The articles were about a lot of things, relationship management, sports, history, pop culture, I would always say it acts as always around famous people, things throughout history in the different buckets, whether it's history or sport or business, you know, always drawn to what that makes people successful. And when people fail, why do they fail? And is there a pattern? And, you know, what do they have to get through to get in a position where they succeed at their craft? And I was always drawn to that, whether it was athletes, entertainers, historians, politicians, and whatnot. And so when it was time to start a company, I won't lie, I was like, I've done everything that I think I can do in terms of text content. And if I'm going to start a company, I'm not going to reinvent the wheel, because all these text-driven media companies exist, but the world is going towards video. And the challenge, being a bit of a masochist, was I'm not a videographer, I'm not a video editor. How can I apply storytelling to video on the internet? I just felt that that was like a great challenge. It was like a wild, wild west, white canvas, you know, no real best practices. And I wanted to be the guy that figured it out. So when we started, it was actually far more horizontal. We did a little bit of everything, you know, how-tos, tips, guides. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, we wanted to kind of develop our craft and kind of flex our muscle and just see, okay, if we do travel videos, are there lessons that we could then apply to music videos and vice versa? But I understand why our audience is confused, because one day they come and there's a, you know, musical interview, the next day there's a travel destination video, the next day there's a cooking recipe, and the next day there's a top 10 list on movies. And, you know, online audiences want to know what they're subscribing to. So we made the decision then and there to just go really, really deep into top 10 factual countdowns on general entertainment and pop culture, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Now, I have read that the first video that was ever published on the site was a video called How to Hide Your Hips.
Correct. The first video we ever produced, like tested, was actually Top 10 Skyscrapers or Top 10 Skylines, but it was so crappy that we probably didn't publish it. But the first video that we actually pressed publish and put out there, indeed, was one of the gals that was producing and hosting videos. She was like, hey, you know, I got this idea. And we said, okay, sure. So that's literally what went live on January 23rd, 2006.
How did this idea start snowballing? So you say that you were a storyteller and you wanted to get into video because you saw that was the future of the internet. But you weren't a videographer, you weren't a video editor. So you must have pulled in some people to help you with this.
Of course, yeah. So the reason why I wanted to start a company was because I remember, to quote General Electric's former CEO, Jack Welch, he used to say there's two things he loved, people and competition. And I read that book as I was graduating college, and that stuck with me. And I said, hey, it's true. I really like people, and I really like to compete. And so for me, part of the desire to actually venture into business, like, I didn't want to start Watch Ash or Ash Mojo. I was really not interested in, you know, like, if you look at the different things like success or fame or wealth or, you know, credibility or whatever. To me, fame was like not even on page one, right? But I really, really wanted to succeed at building an organization and like recruiting people, motivating people, challenging people, and ultimately putting people, like casting them in the right light. So that was something that I liked early on, meeting people and kind of figuring out what they were good at. So I met, you know, when I was producing radio shows, I met an intern at the local college named Rafael Daniel, and we kind of stayed in touch, and he was actually more into videography than like, you know, radio. So when I wanted to venture into this industry, I reached out to him and we met and he joined. You know, my wife and I started the business because we're kind of sitting around going, what do we want to do with our lives? So we were like a good yin to the yang. And so she, over the course of the history of the company, done administration, operation. Today she's the editor in chief and my boss. So, you know, and then kind of recruited. it's a very clear and consistent reality. I have one boss at home and one boss at the office, and it's the same person. So it's really, really.
Well, at least you're not confused. That's good, I guess.
That's the point. I'm a very simple person. And so, yeah, and so we recruited a lot of people. And the best part of our success is that it's really the same original five people, largely, who we've grown around and built around, and we're like 75 full-time. And that's really the best part, because oftentimes when companies succeed, especially after they have challenges early on, is, you know, people are pushed out and new people come on board. And in our case, the best part really is that it's the core original team that's just grown to where we are.
Now, I read, or I think I was watching an interview that you did back in 2012, and you said Ash of 2012 would say to Ash of 2006, are you sure you want to get into content? Because I think it was all about, you know, the output of creating content is a big workload as opposed to managing or advertising, or it was something where you don't have to create as much. How do you feel about that now?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, the Ash of 2012, I guess I've always been a bit of multiple personality guy. look, the reality is content is really hard. And I was very naive into thinking like, wow, you know, you could go raise investment to produce content if you have a good plan. The reality was investors just don't like content. Investors like to build platforms that other content creators can use because platforms scale, whereas content takes time and it's seen as a hits business. I was always very passionate about the content, but I thought naively that I could ultimately convince people that, hey, there could be a business in content. And it was hard, right? The people that I could quote unquote convince to invest maybe weren't the right partners and would not have helped, or they asked for terms, or they wanted us to like replace people that I felt would actually be crucial to our success going forward. So long story short, I guess I would just quantify that by saying, look, if I could foresee that, okay, it might take 10 years, but in 10 years, we're going to be where we are. Mm. You know, obviously I would do some things differently, but I think it was the right bet. But those first 5-6 years were really hard. And I have the strength and perspective to withstand a lot of pain, but I don't think most people could have done that, where for 5 years, literally paycheck to pay. I mean, I wasn't even really paying myself, but to meet payroll of my team, it was a constant struggle. Like, we had good blue chip clients, but we didn't have enough of them. You know, we had recurring revenue, but just not enough volume. So that is really hard. And I whenever entrepreneurs ask me about tips, you know, I have a lot of advice to give and some of it may not be relevant, but the key thing that I tell them is, look, you have to understand there's no such thing as an overnight success. It's going to take a while. You're going to have to withstand a lot of criticism, a lot of ridicule, a lot of like, yeah, whatever, good luck with that, buddy. I'm not sure if it's a business. And even the people that you see being successful, probably it wasn't a straight line, right? So I think that was the context, meaning you really have to be okay with almost investing years, if not a decade of your life before you have anything resembling success.
Yeah. You say that you're quite resilient and have a lot of strength to withstand some pain in that sphere. Did you have any particular techniques or things that you did to kind of keep you focused during those periods where the business wasn't making as much money as you needed?
Yeah, I mean, there's two sides to that, right? There is, I feel like, the business operational side, and then there's like the personal, like spiritual balance, well-being side. Mm. You know, on the business side, I think it's a lot of talking to others, reading, and, you know, not falling into like the kind of, you know, the guy who's always at like events, networking and bragging about how well the company is doing and losing sight of his actual business. So like, I really focused a lot on just, you know, the emails, the blocking and tackling, the production, the content, the partnerships, and, you know, not worrying too much about PR and spin, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that on that side, I would say, is just having an open mind, but not chasing fads, not pivoting four times and finding yourself in the same spot. On the well-being side, I mean, look, it's hard. And the problem was people projected constant success, straight line upwards and to the right. So when an entrepreneur who didn't have that strength, didn't have that perspective, didn't have the network, didn't have balance in their lives, they would unfortunately, like some artists who seemingly have it all, just kind of fall to depression or even addiction or the challenges of coming up with a better musical album or song when you've had your hits in the past, right? And entrepreneurship is kind of like that. You go out there and you kind of think that you are going to build something better tomorrow than you did yesterday. And then you have competition and you have things that are outside of your, you know, outside of your control. And then people lose it, right? So in my case, simple things. Like I remember for the last 15 years, I've played, you know, football, soccer, and trust me, it's anger management and focus and some people jog. And, you know, I find jogging pretty boring, but I tell you, you know, chasing after a football and trying to score and win, simple as it seems, helped a lot. Or, you know, with my wife and I kind of, she was there so she could see it, but we also knew, like, if we came home, you know, life goes on, and we had a couple of kids who, you know, they don't care if you had a good day or a bad day. They want you to go get them their favorite juice and fruit. So I think you have to, you know, you have to be able to just take a step back. You got to take your job seriously, but you can't take yourself seriously. You know, right now, Jeff Bezos of Amazon is the wealthiest man on the planet. So All of a sudden, you're seeing a lot more articles, not so much about business or some business, but it's a lot about, like, Jeff Bezos' view on this, his philosophy. And what's funny is this has been triggered not by his experiences and his actual philosophy, but because he's the wealthiest man on the planet. And the irony is I go, I'm the same guy I was 10 years ago. Obviously, I have more experience. But it's like now that, let's say, we're successful, people may care about certain things. And I understand that's normal. But it just goes to show that as a society, we still care more about, like, wealth than, let's say, success or experience, right? So I think as an entrepreneur, if you get into it for the wrong things, fame, celebrity, wealth, and you don't balance it, then you will probably have a hard time. But if you go into it because there's a bigger reason, so to speak, and you kind of say, hey, whether I'm poor or rich, I'm the same guy. There's things I got to change because maybe they're not healthy or working, but there are things that I believe in, and that's going to be my moral compass, and that's going to be my framework going forward. Then you could withstand a lot, right? And I think when I talk about entrepreneurship, of course I want to talk about videos and editorial and partnerships, but I think it's kind of doing a disservice because you've got to talk a lot more about psychological well-being. You got to talk about balance. You got to talk about eating well and exercise and, you know, being able to just, and some of this is like wishful thinking, you know, trust me, were there nights when, you know, I was like, my God, this is hard. And so much of it is the time, you know, you're waiting for things to happen, but it's like slow. You email an investor all excited and you're expecting a quick answer, but then you get the answer weeks later and it's a no. And how do you not let that bring you down? You know, so that's kind of it. You just have to see the forest through the tree.
And having your wife as part of the company as well, essentially your boss at home and at work, as you said, you must have worked out over the years of doing this a way to separate home and work life.
We do try, and it's not perfect, but I think it works for us. And frankly, if you go back to when I started, I said, we're going to be taking a considerable risk anyway that the, believe it or not, I go in our case, and that doesn't work for everybody because some people need to have one source of income. But in our case, I'd made a little bit of money from my old company. And I just said, because I, that burn, that is going to be burning down to nothing, I rather we just take a little bit higher risk and have you there to help me make better decisions and frankly be aware of dynamics. So if you were to feedback on something at night, I'm not like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about in the nicest way, but there's no way that sounds nice if you say it and then it would escalate into an argument. I said, I actually rather you be there at the office because you're very smart. You have a lot to add. Our expertise and our interests are very aligned and complementary. So for us from the beginning, that's just how I am with partners and people. It's collaborative. Now, are there moments when we might be discussing something and it escalates? Yeah, we're human, but I think we love each other and respect each other. So it never gets off the rails. But one challenge that we've had is at home, as much as we try not to bring work home, we are human. Sometimes we'll bring it up. And even though we're not fighting, we are debating, arguing the way a couple of execs may, and our kids think we're fighting. And that's when we're like, okay, let's stop this, you know. So overall, it works for us. We've divided kind of areas. And I'm actually, the one thing I sometimes tell her is I go, look, I trust you. We can't both be thinking about this because then it'll escalate and it's not healthy. I go the same way that with other colleagues. I go, look, what is your recommendation, what you want to do? And I'll just say, sure, I get it, let's do it. Whenever we try to both be on a topic, I feel that's when it's actually unhealthy. But so long as you kind of discuss, collaborate, but you each are not stepping on one another, in our case, that works. But look, let me be clear about this. 99% of people should not go into entrepreneurship. And of those who do, 99% of them should not be working with their spouses or significant others. Most people just can't do it. But if you can, it works out really well.
Interesting. I want to ask you about, you mentioned before that your first company was acquired. And I have read that there was a little bit of trouble with that transaction moving forward.
Well, the transaction itself was okay. I mean, that was just, you know, we had been around for 5 years as an online men's magazine called Ask Men. And eventually, you know, we had ridden the NASDAQ crash and the dot-com bubble crashing. And, you know, we had kind of become a leading men's lifestyle player. And we grew and grew. And I wanted to go really big, but my partners, I understand, like they wanted to just cash out. So they sold first to a gaming company called IGN Entertainment, which itself got bought out by fellow Australian Mr. Rupert Murdoch. And so when News Corp took over IGN, we kind of were lost in the shuffle and there was really no job for me in the sense that I could have stuck around and just earned my paycheck, but the right thing to do was to shift my responsibilities to the people at those companies. And when I said, okay, look, there's nothing for me to do, I'm going to leave, they were like, yeah, that's fine, go. I said, look, I'm going to start a company. They go, we don't care if you start a company, but just don't go working at these two companies that are our competitors. I said, no. I go, I'm going to start a company, but, you know, thanks for letting me know. And it's funny because a third company that I viewed was a competitor offered me a job, but I said, to me, it's not right. They didn't name this company, but, you know, if they objected, the other one, they'll object to this, right? And so I started a company, and I sent them a note saying, hey, I started this. You said you might even want to invest. Keep me posted. Didn't hear from them. And then one day, bailiff knocks on the door, injunction to shut us down. You're violating your non-compete. Now, I wasn't. And, you know, I even reached out to them, and I was like, look, this must be a misunderstanding. What's going on? And they kind of were ignoring me. And I mean, it was definitely personal. I think it was like to set an example because there was going to be a lot of turnover after News Corp took over IGN and asked them. But I ended up going to court reluctantly by myself and I represented myself and I won. And that actually inadvertently was an experience that, like, you know, wouldn't want to live through it twice, but wouldn't change anything.
How did she come to the decision that you would be representing yourself?
Interesting. There was a strategic and a tactical decision. Strategically, I knew that their goal was not on the merits. They knew that I would probably be able to demonstrate that it was not a competitive publication. But I figured they wanted just to outspend me. And so I said, so long as I, you know, can just you know, I don't think you could be a doctor for a day. You'll kill the patient, but you could definitely, or you can't be a surgeon for a day. Definitely, that patient's not going to see the sunset tomorrow, or the sunrise, or the sunset the first day. But I go, I think you, if you have the right sensitivity, I think you could be a lawyer for a session. And I was very good at debating. And look, I don't lie, right? I think one thing you'll see is I'm pretty credible. I'm very harsh on myself, but like I don't overdo it on the negative side and on the mm-hmm. good side. You know, if I would never pee on your leg and say it's raining. You know, that's an American expression. Let me be clear. Otherwise, you're like, wow. Like, what a crude individual. But so again, yeah. Long story short, I just then when I did speak to a few lawyers, and they said, okay. They go, we're not sure, but like if you go in, the judge may like not even want to hear from you. So you're better off if you have a lawyer. They may just want to at this phase, because it's an injunction, it's very technical. They said the judge may just be like, yeah, we're not talking to you because your lawyer has to speak. We're deciding if this goes to court or we're just going to shut you down until the court. So I said, okay, I'm going to then represent myself because then they have to hear me and I can explain this better. And it worked. So they got up for like 30 minutes and spoke, and I got up for 90 minutes. And I'm like, my lady, I'd like to demonstrate that petitioners don't pass the four tests of an interlocutory injunction. And their eyes just dropped like, wow. Oh my God, he's done his homework. And, you know, I was a bit nervous at first, but then I was like, just fine. And I was just going through it. I'm like, you know, petitioners claim that this claim, that is not a risk. They're just, you know, they're trying to create confusion. You know, they say that defendants may. I go, may. A lot of things may happen. So it was, that was the irony. While I would have won ultimately on the merits, I realized in that specific case, it was really more of like a debate. It was like almost like English, debating mm-hmm. sentence structure. You know, so I destroyed them. I destroyed them in the court. And then they were like, we're going to continue. And then in the aftermath, I kind of found emails that demonstrated even a little bit of perjury. And I wouldn't say malicious perjury, I think more sloppy perjury, but enough that I could then totally destroy their argument. And then I found more material things, and then I went on the offensive. I said, look, I go, I have enough here not just to win, but to countersue you for perjury and like a lot of things, you know. And then they changed their tune, and all of a sudden, like, I was made out to be the bully. And then so we settled, but meaning they just said, okay, we'll drop everything. Just stop talking about this for a year. I said, okay, I'll gladly shut up, which is very hard for me, but I will shut up for a year. Yeah, that's it. So I won. And then, ironically, we were working with all of the other units at News Corp. We had a partnership with IGN. We had a partnership with MySpace. And even the guys who did it, I never really held any grudges. I viewed it as, you know, people, myself included, we've made judgment calls. I like to think 8-9 times out of 10, I make the right judgment call. But it was something maybe I hope they regret. But I never even sat there and said, I'm going to wait for an apology. You know, it was it is what it is. And I had to move on and say, you know, it just goes back to choosing. I guess the lesson, if you're listening, is choose wisely who you work with. And when people say like, oh, don't worry, we wouldn't do this or that. You know what? If you have any doubts, sure, get it in writing and be clear. But ultimately, if your gut tells you that you're working with someone who's not going to do the right thing, then your gut is probably right. And you should avoid working with people if you can who are, you know, who don't match your level of integrity and your level of, you know, honesty and whatnot. But that's life. And we all have experiences like that. So.
It's an incredible, almost David and Goliath type of story.
It was. I don't know. It was. I cast it in the model of David and Goliath, and you know, and actually, when I was studying that, I was kind of going as a student of, you know, history, trying to find out how can I possibly pull this off, and that was the takeaway. David used Goliath's own weapons against him, and that's what I had to do. I could not at the injunction phase. It's funny you mentioned that, but I could not in the injunction phase produce new evidence. I had to argue with the evidence that was on the face of the record, and I had to basically turn their own weapons against them and use their words against them. And it was literally a David and Goliath analogy, because that's what I had to do. And I could see their frustration, and I could see their lawyers go from being very confident and almost like arrogant to cringing and shrinking in their chairs because they could see that I was turning their lies essentially against them.
Wow. That must have been such a sense of accomplishment because you knew in your heart that you were right and this big company was essentially trying to bully you.
Yeah, look, I don't want to lie. I mean, I was very proud and I mention it often. I don't mention it actually in like a cocky, arrogant way because I tell people, yeah, don't be crazy to do this unless you're a masochist. You can withstand a lot of pain and a lot of uncertainty. Seriously, it's crazy. Like, don't do this. What are you thinking? But it did, I go, you do have to use these experiences, you know, and think positively. And you know, we are a company, we work with media companies, the movie studios and the TV networks and record labels, and they would practically pay us practically to cover their works. But absolutely, we rely a lot on fair use, which is an exemption of copyright law or fair dealing in the UK, Canada and Australia, and fair use in the US. And I go occasionally, now it's less and less, but it's always the case, we'll get the odd company or usually employee who may not know better, and they'll come to us and say, oh, we will sue you, you can't do this or that, and we just very respectfully explain that we can, and you know, that we even cite, we go, look, your colleague in marketing or partnerships is reaching out to us, and long story short, you know, we say, look, we're not doing anything wrong. But many times we were able to build a business and sustain and whatnot, because legally I knew that, hey, if I went through that, then whatever I'm going through this day will also pass. And if I could take on News Corp and Rupert Murdoch and, you know, the battalion of lawyers, this is going to be fine. And that actually really, really helped give me the confidence to take on, you know, lawyers and, you know, threats and whatnot. So yeah, I was both proud of it, but it wasn't just proud in an arrogant way. It was actually stay humble, because if you overplay your hand, you're no different than those guys who came in thinking it was a fait accompli, and then they slipped on themselves and hurt themselves, and you prevailed.
I also like what you just said about, you know, if you can withstand this, you can kind of get through anything. You know, this too will pass. Have you, is that kind of something that you have used throughout your business experience?
Throughout my life?
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, look, I'm human. Like, there's moments when I'm paranoid. I'm like, worry about stuff. But absolutely, I am Mr. Zen Master, Yoda, glasses half full, silver lining. There's the only way you could, you know, you could not lose your mind. And absolutely, everything, I go, okay, so it's fine. And that's actually why our culture is pretty good. You know, we don't blame each other. We live and learn, as we say. We say, okay, well, what's the lesson? And, you know, okay. Like, and then that, it creates a healthier dynamic, because we can talk about things and not worry that, oh, does this person think you're blaming them or throwing them under the bus? But absolutely. I mean, that's the only way I feel like, you know, you live on planet Earth once. So, you know, you got to kind of use everything and kind of say, okay, what's the takeaway? And it's also weird, because the lesson you think you learn from a mistake or an experience is probably not the most valuable lesson you're going to use in a future subsequent interaction. But, you know, every day alone, like let me give you one example. I came Friday home after playing soccer. I was upset about something. And I said, okay, I got to change up like my tactic of resolving this. And I did something, and I woke up saying, oh, maybe I shouldn't have sent that note. But in the end, it paid off, right? But I still said, okay, it paid off, and some of it is because of luck. Some of it was reverse psychology. Some of it was just timing or whatever. But I still played both sides, meaning I go, what's the lesson you learned into what you want to avoid in the future? But what is the takeaway? That sometimes you got to think differently. You know, sometimes people do mistake diplomacy and for weakness, and you got to snap them into shape, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like I do that a lot, and it goes back to recruiting and starting a company. I want to build an organization, and I think I have, where I'm ultimately like problem solving and coming up with ideas for, you know, how to accomplish this objective. And most of the time, it's not like, how can I maximize pleasure? It's actually, how do I eliminate or minimize pain? You know, so that's why I think it goes back to entrepreneurship. I think way too many entrepreneurs, like, you know, musicians or athletes, go into it thinking they're going to win the championship or reap the benefits, but they don't realize, like, it's more about managing pain and managing uncertainty. You know, it's like to walk away not embarrassed or humiliated when your projects don't necessarily grow as fast. And I know it sounds super duper, like, you know, self-help guru type, but I mean, it is true that you're only going to succeed in life if you can, you know, have a thick skin, but not be so overconfident that you don't learn from the things you're probably not doing well, but are confident enough that you double down on the things that you are.
That's true. It's a great bit of advice. Now I want to ask you again about Watch Mojo. I've read a number of things and you listed a number off the top of, you know, how many subscribers it has and a few brands that it's worked with. Do you have a favorite bit of success that Watch Mojo has achieved?
I mean, look, yes, of course. I do love the fact, like I said earlier, that it's the same team that's grown. I really like that a lot because it does show that My decision when, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why some investors didn't want to invest, and, you know, some very good, some less good. But when I would say, well, wait, look, I don't agree necessarily that we need to replace this guy or that girl because you think they're inexperienced. I think they have the right skill set, so to speak. The fact that it's the same team, I love that. That's one. Mm. Two, you know, the fact that we did this without outside capital means we built an actual business that makes sense. It pulls in more revenue than it, you know, has expenses. We're independent. It means we don't have, admittedly, a huge safety net if we make a couple of mistakes. But it also, to me, shows that, you know, we were smart about how we approached it. And then finally, yeah, I mean, look, I think the fact that we built the most successful media brand on YouTube. So, you know, there's a lot of popular Vevo channels. Like, yes, Taylor Swift may have more views than us, and I can live with that. But when it comes to, like, you know, companies that wanted to build a business, you know, around web video. And, you know, when I look at what I set out to do, in some ways I thought we'd be bigger, and in some ways we may be, you know, bigger than I thought or whatever. But I basically set out to build, you know, the top. And I was never interested in, like, building the biggest. I wanted to build, like, the best, meaning, like, the most respected, most admired type of thing. And I'm not saying we're there yet, but I stuck to my guns within reason, and I feel like that's probably the best part of the success story, so to speak.
Wow. Now all of this, all of your strategies, I believe, are in your book, the 10-Year Overnight Success and Entrepreneur's Manifesto. Where can people find that if they would like
to? They could find it everywhere, Amazon, our website. We could do a giveaway if you want to give some books away to your followers. But it's,
oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah, it sure, yeah, my pleasure. I mean, it was a book I wrote because it was 10 years. So I wrote my first book in a month, and that was probably when I was 23. And then I wrote my second book on Alexander the Great in a week, but I'd studied him all my life. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't write a book for, like, let's say 10 years. And then when Watch Mojo, yeah, and then I started Watch Mojo. So then when Watch Mojo celebrated its 10th year, it was just like, it was both like almost therapeutic. I wanted to just close that chapter because I was thinking a lot about the future personally, the future for the company. And it's just, I was on a 3-week vacation to Greece with my wife and two daughters, and I was, you know, eating well, drinking well, swimming well, and enjoying the sun. But somehow I found the time to write, you know, like a 250-page book on the, it's kind of more like a history of web video. It's a look at YouTube success, but not as an outsider, someone that was in the trenches trying to figure it out. It's a story of persistence. I think most people will relate to it because it's like Ashes and Watch Mojo and YouTube story. But it's like, you know, you could be an athlete, you could be a musician, you could be a, you know, somebody wanting to be a doctor. And it's just constantly about, hey, you hit a wall and you got to kind of find a way to get through that wall. And then last but not least, I won't lie, as the company wanted to evolve and get into other forms of content, whether it's unscripted originals or scripted programming, I said, hey, I could write this book and eventually it could be adapted into a feature film, you know, if you fictionalize it about some guy who starts a startup, or you can use some of the stories and create something like a TV show, like, let's say, Mad Men or Billions, because it takes you through, like, you know, the rise of web video, which everyone kind of has experienced from their own vantage point. So admittedly, there was like kind of three points to doing it. And so it's, people seem to like it because it's relatable. It's a story about overcoming setbacks and achieving your goal.
Well, that's exactly how I feel about this interview. There are so many points that you touched on with, I've spoken with a lot of entrepreneurs doing this podcast and just in connections that have been made through it. And a lot of the early startup struggles, are similar for a lot of people. And I thank you for coming on and talking so openly and honestly about your journey and how you have gone from one point to the next and the experiences that you've had through that. So I thank you for coming on and sharing that.
Thank you very, very much. It's my pleasure.
So now you mentioned that your book is everywhere. It's on Amazon. And I know that WatchMojo has its own website. It's also on YouTube. Are there any other areas that you would like to plug for people to go on?
I would say we're kind of everywhere. It's funny you mentioned that because our vision is inform and entertain through video. And for the longest time, the mission, which is what changes, is with the video on every topic. But now our mission is actually everywhere you are. So we are kind of increasingly everywhere, whether it's Facebook and Twitter, and moving into different forms of programming. But no, that's pretty much it. Just, YouTube is where the action is at. Enjoy them there and, share them, enjoy them, give us feedback on how it could be better. And, if you have also ideas you want to pitch for shows, we are getting bigger where we are. We are actually taking in submissions and ideas as well. So that's also something that people who are listening to this and are storytellers themselves are welcome to submit ideas.
That's great. It sounds like an incredible online community that you've built.
It is the Mojoholics, 10 years in the making.
Yes. Well, I do know, I should have mentioned this at the start, but my brother Dave does work for Ash's company, WatchMojo, and he feels very much a part of this online community, and he very much celebrates it outside of just the work itself.
Yeah, it's true, and it's fascinating because Dave was the first, I would say, recruit that was a fan who kind of crossed the line in a good way. Like he said, hey, I'm in town. I know you guys are based in Montreal. I like the site, but I want to talk to you guys. And he came in and he was very passionate. And I was asking him questions on what he would do and what would make it better. And that's when I was like, okay, we're now really on the right track, that we have our fans reaching out and wanting to join. But Dave was, I would say, the first one with that profile. Like before the people that we, before, it's funny because Dave is always like, Dave is like Jesus. It's before Jesus and after him. So Dave, to me, I'm sure you don't want him to hear that, because next time he's home for dinner, he's like, guys, Jesus has arrived.
Oh, that'd be,
but to me, there's always before and after Dave.
Oh, that's so funny. Well, Dave's story, Dave moved from Australia to Montreal to live with his now wife, but he knew nobody. He didn't know how to speak French. He still doesn't, but he just created a new life for himself in Montreal, coming from the Gold Coast, Australia. It's just completely chalk and cheese. So the fact that he found WatchMojo and he was always passionate about video. And so the fact that he found this company that he loved beforehand is just incredible. The stars aligned for him. Yeah.
No, that's fantastic. I mean, you got to be passionate about what you do. And I mean, I love what I do, and Dave seems to love it too. And it was a good fit.
It's perfect. Well, Ash, I very much appreciate you coming and sharing your story today and being so honest and open. And I cannot wait for people to hear the lessons that you have learned and hopefully we'll be able to follow in some of your footsteps.
Thank you very much for the kind words.
To make sure you get the next episode of I Made This, hit subscribe on your podcast app. And if you know of someone who would love this episode or this series, please tell them about it. All the info you can find at the website, imadethispodcast, all one word, .com.